And welcome back. Now, this segment, Linda Moltenhau will talk about bats. Now, she's not doing a report on vampires, though that would be an interesting program one day. This has to do with what's going on in our environment. What is happening to the bats? We'll have that story when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We've got Linda Moltenhau. Linda, tell us about this bat story you've been working on.
Well, remember I was having editing problems with my new computer, and when we assembled the CD for L.A., it's the fourth cut, and the third cut is Monsanto antitrust and genetic engineering seeds. So if you want me to proceed as the way those cuts are on the CD and on the segment down run, I would do Monsanto now.
All right, let's do Monsanto now just to be safe, okay?
Yeah, and in a way it sets kind of the stage for the fact that all of this genetically engineered world that is beginning to take over may be part of the problem with bats, pollinators, amphibians, and a lot of Earth life. So it was 2 weeks ago, north of Des Moines, Iowa, that the U.S. Departments of Justice and Agriculture held the first in a series of public meetings with farmers, Monsanto, and agriculture businessmen. The subject is an antitrust investigation of the seed industry with a focus on Monsanto and its genetically engineered seeds that make corn, soybeans, cotton, and other crops resistant to insects and herbicides, such as Monsanto's Roundup. Well, the New York Times reported that very same day about the meeting and said that in only the past year, corn seed prices rose 32%, soybean seed prices are up 24%, and that further, nearly all of those crops are now grown from genetically engineered seed.
They've got the market.
Monsanto, in fact, when it comes to soybean, it may now be 95%. Monsanto not only sells its own brand of genetically engineered seeds, also known as GE seeds, but licenses its patented genetic traits to hundreds of small seed companies with very complex binding contracts. And they charge fees to use Monsanto's genetically patented traits. Many frustrated farmers and other critics say the licenses give Monsanto excessive control over the seed business, nearly a monopoly. I called Monsanto's media office and asked for an on-the-record interview with a corporate representative about GE seed prices and the Department of Justice antitrust investigation. After several days and my repetitive inquiry, I was told that Monsanto would not authorize an interview. But I received by email Monsanto's official one-paragraph comment about the meeting in Iowa that included this statement, quote, "With dozens of trait technologies available to farmers today and 50 new traits currently under development, it is clear that competition with the U.S. seeds industry is growing. The fight to win the farmers' business is intense. We remain committed to investing in new products for farmers, products that present another option on farms and offer them more value for their farm," close quote. I also contacted Charles Benbrook. He's PhD and former executive director of the Agriculture Board in the National Academy of Sciences. Since 2005, Dr. Benbrook has been chief scientist for the Organic Center in Enterprise, Oregon. Recently, in a report that he did about rapidly rising GE seed prices, he wrote, quote, "At the present time, there is a massive disconnect between the sometimes lofty rhetoric from those championing biotechnology as the proven path toward global food security and what is actually happening on farms in the U.S. that have grown dependent on GE seeds and are now dealing with the consequences," close quote. I asked Dr. Benbrook to describe the consequences he sees and why GE seed prices are rising so rapidly. Here now is Dr. Benbrook.
In 2010, as farmers move out into their fields this year, they'll be planting the most expensive seeds they've ever bought because of these GE traits, but they'll be wondering, you know, how well they're going to work. There's a lot of very troubling signs about genetically engineered corn and soybeans in terms of their performance and whether they'll even continue to work because of resistance. And at the same time, the companies have doubled the price of the seed in the last 3 or 4 years. And farmers just aren't willing to give up perhaps a third of their income per acre, the money that they're left with after paying all their production costs. Some of them are just not willing to give up a third of that, or sometimes even more, to Monsanto and Syngenta and Dow and the other companies that now have a corner on the seed market.
The New York Times, in a March 12th article under the headline "Rapid Rise in Seed Prices Draws Government Scrutiny," it says, quote, "Farmers watched the prices they paid for seeds skyrocket. Corn seed prices have risen 32%. Soybean seeds have been up 24% in this last year," close quote. Could you comment about why these prices keep rising during a time of such economic recession?
Well, the price of genetically engineered corn, soybeans, and cotton today is driven by the number of genetically engineered traits that the industry has embedded into the commercial seed varieties that are being sold to farmers. When Roundup Ready soybeans were first developed and marketed, BT corn and BT cotton back in 1996, 97, 98, the GE crop revolution, the vast majority of the seeds had only one trait and at most two traits embedded in them. And there was an extra charge or a seed premium added to the cost of a bag of seed for each individual trait. Well, in crop season 2010, the current crop season, this will be the first year that corn farmers will purchase and plant genetically engineered seed with 8 different genetically engineered traits in a single seed. It's the so-called smart stack corn being co-marketed by Monsanto and Dow. So these corn seeds, they have 8 premium prices added together, which is why a bag of this seed for many farmers is going to list for $320, translating into a cost of about $125 an acre to plant a field of corn, whereas less than a decade ago, many farmers were planting corn for $25 an acre. That $100, the increase in the cash cost of seed, that's more money than farmers make in profit from growing an acre of corn in probably 8 out of 10 years. Really, what Monsanto and the biotech industry have figured out is a way that now they have extracted from the income on an acre of corn an amount of money roughly equal to what the government subsidies have been, and farmers now are just squeezed down to nothing.
In a September 15th, 2009 speech, Monsanto's chief executive officer, Hugh Grant, reaffirmed the company's goal of doubling gross profits in 2012 from 2007 levels, and that Mr. Grant stated, "Increases in the price of the new RR2 soybeans and Smart Stacks corn hybrids will create about one-third of the company's gross profit growth in 2012. Net farm returns are likely to be the primary source of these new profits," close quote, reinforcing what you have just described, but raising, what is Monsanto counting on amid all this grumbling about genetically engineered seeds and the rising prices and the lowering quality of crops? Why is Monsanto so confident that it can double its gross profits in 5 years?
Well, Monsanto has achieved a level of market power and political power over the agricultural industry, the agricultural community, and certainly the seed markets, that is simply unprecedented. Monsanto genetics that are behind most of the genetically engineered soybeans and corn and cotton.
Please explain what the Justice Department's antitrust investigation is doing right now.
The core concern about Monsanto's business practices is that through the provisions in their licensing agreements, where Monsanto provides to an independent seed company, say, access to the gene that would make corn or soybeans Roundup Ready, in those licensing agreements, Monsanto has inserted additional provisions that tie the hands of these once independent seed companies in terms of what other seeds they can sell, what other traits they can try to incorporate into their seeds. In every way imaginable, Monsanto has used its market power and the demand for its traits to extend contract provisions that reduce the ability of other companies to compete with it. And they've probably overplayed their hand quite substantially, because one of the tactics that they've really excelled at, it's called bundling. And basically, the way bundling works is a company that sells several different things. And remember, Monsanto sells Roundup herbicide, and it also sells the seeds, the Roundup Ready seeds. So clearly, Monsanto wants to sell the farmer both the seed and its brand of Roundup, because it doesn't make any money off the herbicide sales if a farmer buys some other company's brand of Roundup. And let's remember, glyphosate, the molecule that goes into Roundup, is off patent. So there's generic Roundup from several foreign countries. There's several chemical companies in the United States that make it. So it's a commodity chemical. There's no way that Monsanto can sustain sort of monopoly profits on Roundup, but they still want to control a high market share. The way that they do that is they'll put a price on the seed that's very high if a farmer just buys the seed. But if the farmer signs a contract that says they'll buy all of their seed from Monsanto involving Monsanto traits, and they'll buy all their Roundup from Monsanto from the various Roundup products that are available, then Monsanto will give them a 15% discount on the combined price of the seed and the herbicide. That's illegal. That's bundling. That is a tool of market manipulation that the Justice Department has taken action on multiple times. And so I think Monsanto's use of bundling, of rebates, of incentives that are all linked to buying just Monsanto products will come under the closest scrutiny.
Dr. Benbrook, what if it turns out the genetically engineered crops hurt earth life from honeybees and bats to people?
The part of this puzzle that doesn't get nearly the attention that it deserves are the new seed treatments that are necessary to protect the GE corn and soybean and cotton plants, which actually they're kind of weak when they first germinate. They're highly vulnerable to plant disease and insect attacks. They're just not as vigorous and healthy as conventional seeds. And so the biotech industry has come up with this new generation of seed treatments that are actually kind of like delayed-release pills that are coated so that the medicine is delivered gradually over a period of time. Well, they've done the same thing with seed treatments now by embedding the pesticides used in the seed treatment in these polymers that break down and release the seed treatment over a period of weeks as opposed to just over a day or two. And I believe several of these pesticides that are being used as seed treatments, they're called systemics, systemic pesticides. The way that they work is that they actually move right into the plant, up through the root system and into the tissues, the growing tissues of the plant. And so any insect, any animal that's feeding on these young plants is going to be exposed to actually a relatively high level of them. There's new evidence of bees being exposed to these systemic seed treatments in the early part of the growing season that is weakening their immune system, disrupting their neurological systems so that they can't navigate their way back to the hive, which is a signature of colony collapse disorder. I think that these residues could be impacting many other non-target organisms, from bats to frogs to insects. We've so profoundly changed how we grow corn and soybeans and cotton in this country, and we've really turned them into kind of toxic crops. The corn and cotton are engineered to actually manufacture insecticides inside all the plant cells, and we're coating the seeds with these systemic pesticides that move into the plants. We have to step back and ask ourselves, why have we had to step up this chemical warfare on corn, soybean, and cotton farms so dramatically since 1996? And I think fundamentally the answer is that a technology came along, genetic engineering, where the private sector realized there were some ways to create patent-protected profits in major crops that were associated with these pest management kind of traits, turning the crops into little mini insecticide factories, creating herbicide-tolerant crops. And this set us down a path that has thrown at Mother Nature in all of these fields this increasing diversity and mix of toxic chemicals and toxic plants.
Boy, they got a market on that, Linda, huh?
Well, you know, this is really serious stuff. And it is especially serious because there isn't anyone from Monsanto to the National Academy of Sciences who can guarantee where will we be in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now on this planet if everything is genetically engineered with systemic pesticides, that already there are reports that are coming out about problems with the GE plants and the systemic issues of pesticides. And one of them, Dr. Benbrook pointed out that there is a huge and growing concern that there is now a spread of what are called glyphosate-resistant weeds. You know, glyphosate is the generic for what Monsanto sells is Roundup. And what's happening is that with these, I guess you would call it crops that have the herbicide built into them genetically, that now whole sections, new weeds, are beginning to take over, especially in the southeastern states, where Roundup Ready cotton is grown in rotation with Roundup Ready soybeans. And already, farmers there are dealing with three or four seriously resistant weeds that are right now essentially uncontrollable with today's herbicides. And so what do? They have to go and add two, three, four different poisons trying to get rid of the weeds. And in the process, as he pointed out to me, this has to have an impact on the environment, and that I have talked privately with some scientists who have done some work on the possibility that some of the systemic pesticide plants and the pollen are linked, even though they can't prove it, to what is happening with pollinators, what is happening with amphibians, and maybe part of this whole huge syndrome, maybe part of what is happening to the bats that I'm going into in the next half hour, this is crisis proportion with bats. And it's interesting to note that 2006, the fall to February of 2006, is when colony collapse disorder in the pollinators, honeybees especially, cropped up, and when they started finding hundreds of thousands of bats dead.
All right, Linda, and then up next, we'll continue with Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll have conversations with Linda, but when we come back, she'll finish up with her reports now on bats on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Linda, that would be an interesting segment for you one day, is to do a series of reports on vampires and why people tend to do this. You know, in some cases, they go to dentists to have actual vampire-looking teeth implanted. It's amazing.
You can do that story, George.
I love it. Anyways, tell me this one. What's going on with the bats?
It's getting more and more serious. A week ago, in Louisville, Kentucky, the federal Fish and Wildlife Service held a meeting with federal and state biologists to work on a national, implement a plan for white nose syndrome that continues to kill hibernating bats in huge numbers. In some bat hibernation sites this winter, 99%, maybe 100% of the bats are dead. One site is the graphite mine in New York's Adirondacks. This once had the largest count of little brown bats in North America, about 200,000 animals hibernating in there in the winter. But recently, the count is down to only 2,000. 2,000 out of 200,000. The killer appears to be the fungus called Geomyces destructens that leaves white rings around the bats' noses and infects ears and wings. Unheard of before February 2006. The white nose fungus syndrome has now spread in 4 years from the Northeast all the way to Tennessee. Infected states are now up to 11. Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, and now Tennessee. Then on March 19th, Ontario's Ministry of Natural Resources reported the first case of white nose fungus ever found in Canada. Several bats in the Bancroft-Minden area, 124 miles west of Ottawa, are infected. At the Kentucky meeting, I was able to talk by phone with wildlife biologist Scott Darling, who has worked for the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department for 28 years. He and his colleagues have never seen anything like this before, and I asked him if the bat die-offs are now at a crisis level. Here now is wildlife biologist Scott Darling.
Oh, absolutely. It's now spread from New York and northern New England all the way down into Tennessee. And so the spread is as dramatic as we can have imagined.
11 states. Where might be the next states in which this could show up?
Well, the states that are closest to Tennessee, Kentucky, is one we're very worried about. And in states like Tennessee and Kentucky, where the cave system is many times larger and more complex than we have in Vermont.
Well, which bats seem to be the most vulnerable?
Well, it's been very interesting this year as we have been monitoring hibernating bat populations, and the little brown bat has been devastated. And the northern long-eared bat, which really we had viewed as one of our more common species as well, is nearly absent from our counts in the caves and mines this year. And the truth of the matter is other species are affected as well, but when you compare with what we have seen happening to little brown bats and the long-eared bats, it's not nearly as dramatic, but it still is happening. And so I think the concern is some of these species may be declining at a more rapid rate than others, but the trends are clearly down in nearly all of our cave bat species.
Do you think that any of those, let's say the little brown bat or the northern long ear, could go into extinction if this white nose syndrome cannot be stopped?
That surely is a logical conclusion from what we're seeing. But at the same time, we always hold on to hope, and we'll keep working and do all we can to keep that from happening. These bats have been around for some 50 million years. And have been able to adapt very well to their natural conditions. And in this very short span, under our watch, they're disappearing from our forests and our ecosystems. And that alone should be enough of a concern. We are experiencing other declines globally with amphibians. And here in the United States, we have concerns about honeybee colony collapse disorders. And so I often look at this as really almost the third red flag that we have thrown at us in the last few years here in the eastern United States. And I think it's time for us to make sure that we're paying the due attention that these crises require.
Well, you're suggesting that there's something going on the planet that is making it possible for a new fungus to thrive. Something is attacking the pollinators. Something is attacking the amphibians. It may be fungus. It may be pesticides. What do you do to try to turn this around in terms of the bat die-off?
Try to control it, slow its spread, as well as perhaps even treat the fungus on the bats.
Do you mean hand by hand that you'd have to take each bat and dip it somehow in a fungicide?
Well, Al Hicks from New York DEC has taken that on as an experimental effort to evaluate the methodology and the practicality of that this past season. And at this point in time, there's nothing that would preclude us from continuing to go down that track.
There are at least four bat species dying off in this mystery. The little brown bat, the northern long-eared bat, the Indiana bat, and the eastern pipistrelle. Since the Indiana bat is on the endangered species list, the mammal specialist in New York's endangered species program in the Department of Environmental Conservation is deeply involved in trying to stop the rapid spread of bat deaths. He is Alan Hicks, who has a degree in wildlife management and has worked for New York's Endangered Species Program since 1979. Alan Hicks has never seen white fungus rings around the noses of sick and dying bats before 2007, and he is now so concerned that by February 2010, he gathered people to help him take hibernating bats one by one from their respective cave roosts to apply fungicides by hand.
We have sites that we've surveyed just recently that had around 99% mortality.
Wow, where are they?
In the lower Hudson region of New York and up in the Adirondacks. One of them was the largest winter colony of little brown bats counted in North America, 200,000 animals. And when we went in, that number dropped to about 2,000.
Oh, my gosh. And does that mean that you were looking at a floor of nothing but dead bats for several feet thick?
Oh no. Mortality occurred over the last 3 years. So, in fact, in there, you're looking at a big empty chamber where you used to see many thousands of animals. We've never experienced anything like this. We may, at least in the short run, need to protect individual bats from this disease by applying an antifungal agent is something that we're looking into. Our first test applications just a month ago.
And how did you apply it?
We had quite a large crew because it isn't merely a function of going in and applying the compound. You need to do the whole process so that you can understand if you have different results from animals that are treated and animals that are not treated.
So you have a baseline versus those that have been...
Yeah, we have controls and we have experimental groups. And for this year, the primary interest was developing the technique. So we had people at different stations and folks collecting the bats and bringing them back. And you would hold them in a certain way in a certain position. And different things would be done. They'd be weighed and a whole range of things. And at the same time, these guys are going in with limited fat reserves, so you don't want this disturbance to cause them to burn more energy than they need to, so we would provide an external heat source for the bats so that as they go from a body temperature fairly close to freezing up into the high 90s, they're not expending a great deal of energy doing so.
Bringing in a space heater while you do this work?
Oh, no. We would collect them, put them in individual paper bags, the kind that your kids would take to lunch to school in, and so that they're not in contact with other bats and you're not transferring the disease or anything from one to another. And the bats are handled with latex gloves, and you change gloves between animals.
So you are keeping them warm while you apply different experimental fungicides?
Yes, and then we'd take them back into the cave and put them in the spot where they could leave when they wanted to and go to whatever roost they wanted to. We tallied how many animals, and they're all individually banded, so we'll know which bat received which treatment. And we photographed them before, so we had some sense of infection. and all this kind of stuff.
Hibernacula can contain thousands and thousands of bats. How would humans hand fungicide that many bats?
They used to hold hundreds of thousands of bats in some cases, but they don't hold hundreds of thousands of bats any longer.
You mean because of the die-off, the numbers of bats that you have to even try to save is so much fewer now?
Sure.
The very fact that you all have gone to trying to hand fungicide each bat underscores the problem that so many have died off that you could even consider this as an approach to stopping the fungus.
Yeah, if you have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, yeah, it's out of the question. But now we're down to places that had thousands, now have dozens. And it's no big deal to be able to handle all of the bats in many of our sites now. Yeah, it's been a dramatically severe.
And George, when you realize that sentence, 50 million years, bats have flourished on the earth.
Yeah, that and tells you something.
Yeah, and suddenly since 4 years ago, in the 2006 to 2007 time period, they have declined to such a state. I mean, when you just think about 200,000 down to 2,000, and some caves, I have photographs in this report at earthfiles.com of a cave in which all of the bats, 100% last year, were dead. And there is a brand new map that has been put out by Bat Conservation International, and I have that in my earthfiles.com report, and it's entitled White Nose Syndrome and Bat Hibernation Areas, dated March 22nd, 2010, only 3 days ago. And it shows in red where they have now found the white nose fungus. And then it has these yellow arrows that come down and show that right now we are on the verge of this spreading into Kentucky and into Missouri and into Indiana and in that whole area where there are huge, complex cave systems that bats use. And so if we've lost over 1 million or 2 million bats between upper New England down to Tennessee up to these 4 years, what is going to happen if this continues to spread west into these huge hibernacula and they can't stop this fungus? And on top of that, the fungus has never been seen to do anything like this before either. So we have that strange demarcation of the fall of 2006 into the winter or the early months of 2007 as being when colony collapse disorder was identified, when the bats began dying with the white stuff around their noses and their ears and on their wings that they then identified as this fungus that they had never seen before. And we know that amphibians are dying in accelerating rates around the planet, also from fungi, from fungus, the chytrid fungus. And I think that you could hear that Mr. Darling is bringing it up. Dr. Benbrook is bringing it up. Many scientists have brought it up to me off the record. Is there a connection between the increasing uses of pesticides and herbicides, and especially now the layering, multiple layerings, because of genetically engineered crops that are producing the glyphosate or other herbicide-resistant weeds? And now you've got a combination of more and more poison being put on soil and plants for almost like dominoes falling from something that began only in 1996. The first Monsanto genetically engineered crops began in 96, and we're at 2010. So we're talking about, 14 or 15 years, essentially. And all these problems are beginning to crop up. And there is another recent report. It just came out this week. It's from the Public Library of Science. These are amazing statistics. It's a study that had been done on pollen and GE crops and other crops that were not GE. So it was a mixture. And they found, one found about 3 out of 5 pollen and wax samples from 23 states had at least one systemic pesticide. That's a genetically engineered crop. And now EPA officials said that they are aware of problems involving pesticides and bees, and the agency is, quote unquote, very seriously concerned. And this PLOS study found 121 different types of pesticides within 887 wax, pollen, bee, and hive samples. And the conclusion at Penn State by the researchers was that none of this pollen is in good shape. Well, if we now are finally beginning to get scientific data about the fact that there's 121 different types of pesticides in 887 samples of wax, pollen, bee, and hive samples, and we're standing back and still asking the question, what might be wrong with the pollinators? Doesn't it seem logical that the pesticides keep growing as a much bigger figure in all of this in many different directions? And even though they don't understand why the fungus in the bats has suddenly emerged in that 2006 to 2007 time frame with this fungus that they had never seen before, could it all be related? And I think that in a story that I'm going to do on Coast, either next month or the month after, it's going to be about this new growing awareness and scientists beginning to speak about the problems that genetically engineered crops are now beginning to show in the weed resistance and in the bad pollen. And Europe is working overtime to try to resist genetically engineered crops. And it now appears also that the nation of India is trying to put the brakes on. And I know that farmers will say that they have had more crop yield and less problems up to a point. But now a whole new money economic problem has been overlaid, because if you have a monopoly during a recession in 12 months, that these prices would have jumped to 30%, 24% for genetically engineered seeds. That's the problem. We have Earth life that appears perhaps to be hurt, and we have farmers that are now being hurt. And it is a gigantic problem, and the Department of Justice and the Department of Agriculture are now looking at the whole seed price rise in the whole big question. Do they have antitrust issues here with Monsanto? And this is not going away, George. This is
not at all.
This is going to be with us, I think, for the foreseeable future. And a lot will come out as they continue to have these hearings in different farm states with very frustrated and upset farmers and competitors as big as DuPont. DuPont is in a lawsuit with Monsanto right now, and this is going to have a big impact on our food from here on out.
All right, Linda, stay with us, because up next, conversations with Linda and you.